But I have a question. Okay, you ready? So, does the Buddha have Buddha nature? What do you think, Carrie? The Buddha doesn't have Buddha nature? Wait a minute, do you have Buddha nature?
Actually, yes.
Okay. Did Adolf Hitler have Buddha nature? George Bush? You had to think about that one. Every sentient being has this Buddha potential or Buddha lineage, but, or let's say the Buddha nature, if you wanted to call it nature, that maybe it isn't called exactly nature or Buddha lineage, but you're saying, or Petra said, she sort of courageously called out, no, the Buddha doesn't have Buddha nature. Why not?
Already completely actualized, so it no longer exists as potential.
Do you hear it? Because it's potential. So, in fact, that's the basis for a lot of debate about this, because sometimes in some of the interpretations of Uttara Tantra, especially this about Buddha nature and the Tathagata Garbha Sutra, some interpretations take literally the 9 similes that are coming later, and they take it to mean that there is, within our continuum now, a fully enlightened Buddha that will remain until we're enlightened, and we just don't know it. Our teachers, the Dalai Lama and the great Gelugpa Lamas, the interpretation is that is not logically correct to think at all. There's a lot of fallacies to think that we're already Buddha and we don't know it. You know, we're supposed to be omniscient, fully developed, and yet we're ignorant of the fact. It's sort of contradictory. So a crucial kind of point is just what Petra was suggesting, was that the definition of this Buddha potential, let's say, or Buddha lineage, or Tathagata Garbha, the natural abiding lineage, is the emptiness of the defiled mind, the emptiness of the mind which is still with stain. So you could, what, does an arhat have Buddha potential? What do you think, Sophia? Does arhat have, Hinayana arhat have Buddha potential?
Yes.
They do, but they've eliminated the stains, haven't they? They've achieved nirvana.
Not an aspiration to knowledge, right?
Pardon?
This two aspirations.
Right, exactly. They've eliminated one of the stains, the deluded obscurations, but they haven't eliminated the more subtle stains that would allow them enlightenment. So they do still have a mind with stain or obscuration, so they still have Buddha potential, so they can become Buddha. But it said the Buddha does not have, just for some logical reasons like this, the Buddha doesn't have Buddha potential. You could also ask this, is the Buddha a Buddhist? Have we discussed this before? Did we talk about this? No? We did. Huh? What do you think? Diana, is Buddha a Buddhist? Oh, yeah, sorry. I have to ask some of the guys. Dan, I've been hitting only the ladies. Is a Buddha a Buddhist? What is required? What's the definition, the defining characteristic of being a Buddhist?
Aspiring to be a Buddha.
Pardon?
You're aspiring to be a Buddha.
To be a Buddhist, do you have to aspire to be Buddha? Then that would mean the Hinayanas aren't Buddhists.
Take refuge in
the You have to take. Very good. You have to take rest. He's the newcomer, he knew. You have to take refuge from the depth of your heart in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, right?
That's the defining characteristic of a Buddhist in practice, whether you call yourself a Buddhist or whatever. And so does the Buddha take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha? So there's some debate about that. Pardon?
If the Buddha's already actualized, it's kind of like what you were saying. Why would he, she need to take refuge?
Exactly, exactly my point. Yeah. So that would mean the Buddha is not a Buddhist.
Jesus is not a Christian.
Highway 17
Santa Cruz. It's Highway
17
Santa Cruz.
What is the
path? One's the path and one's the destination.
One's the path and one's the destination. Oh, you mean Route 17 goes to Santa Cruz. Oh, talk about self-centered.
It was just a small analogy.
Okay.
Can I just ask a question? Because
yeah.
It's a question that I would ask.
Okay.
So I'll word it differently.
Here it comes again.
So, in the continuum of an enlightened being, in the, which they have mental continuum just as we do, and you say that we don't have a Buddha in us, and I get that I'm not a Buddha, an enlightened being, but since they can see past, present, and future, they are aware of this moment here with me. And that's my mental continuum. So that's a
memory. That's not.
Is the Buddha having awareness of a now, or is the Buddha having a memory?
Yeah, it said the Buddha knows the past, present, and future, but he is. I remember this summer asking Geshe Zopa about, when we talk about, you know, sometimes one of the qualities of Buddha is to recollect all his past lives, to know the past, present, and future. It's said to be known with direct perception. It's not via the faculty of what we call memory. It's not like, let me think, what did I do that life? I got up, I had coffee. It's not like we remember. The Buddha knows, but the Buddha, it's not as though everything is present now with the Buddha. The Buddha's experiences, it's not as though once attaining enlightenment he can go back into the past and change things into the past. The past is already past.
So the Buddha does know your future achievement and enlightenment, will know what happened at this time. But
is the Buddha coming in and out of a direct perception of now?
The Buddha's always in direct perception. So, but your future Buddha doesn't exist yet, right?
Well, I'm not experiencing that.
It's usually we would say logically that your future Buddha doesn't exist yet. The potential doesn't exist anywhere. Your future Buddha doesn't exist at this point. Your future Buddha doesn't exist, but the potential for you to become Buddha exists.
So can I ask you a question? If I was a Buddha, would I be able to see my Buddhahood today? So, for example,
if you were a Buddha now,
if our precious lamas, Lama Zopa, Kirin Benjamin Rinpoche, have omniscient, enlightened mind, then they can see past, present, and future, then they would actually be able to see my Buddhahood now. So then it must
they be. Would see, they see the future, your future achievement of enlightenment.
But if they see it now,
they see it now, but they don't see that it is now. They see it that it's in the future.
Okay.
They don't see that you are presently Buddha and you don't know it.
I don't bore anyone else.
No. Does that make sense?
Say for instance,
Dorje is in Buddha. So he knows that in 17 lifetimes or whatever, or 3 lifetimes or 3 years from now, I don't know, 5 minutes from now, you'll become enlightened.
And he knows that through direct perception.
He knows it through direct perception.
Right here. He knows all the past, present, and future. This is the Mahayana presentation of what omniscience means. Of course, in the Theravada school, it's not believed the Buddha knows the past, present, and future all simultaneously with direct perceptions. One believes he has to turn his mind to certain things and doesn't know everything. But anyway, the Mahayana believes the Buddha's omniscience is all of it, does know all of the past from beginningless time to all of the future, but not in the sense of it all being, he knows that now, presently, but it's not that those are present now, that he can go back into the past or that he can go into the future.
No, because he's aware, always aware. So, but he is also manifesting in different ways.
He's manifesting at all places, omnipresent, through all of the universe at this moment and in succeeding moments, but he is not present in the past. He knows the past by some different means than being present in the past and actually observing it, because the Buddha's the Buddha's mind. I don't know how to explain that. That's the Buddha. Okay.
So that those kind of those, yeah. See Dorje. You can see Dorje after class, and I think he likes. He's particularly fond of Snickers bars, so that may get you an in with him there. No, I'm joking. I don't think he'd like Snickers at all. So, Rinpoche did mention about potential. And in particular, and then he began to give a little bit of explanation in a very general sense about the first three categories, first three of the seven Vajrayana categories, the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And so there's a little bit of some discussion that could come here. Does anyone remember what Rinpoche said the relative Buddha jewel is and the ultimate Buddha jewel?
The relative Hinayana and the ultimate was Mahayana.
But he's saying so softly, you didn't hear him, but he said the relative is the Hinayana Arhat, meaning actually Rinpoche, the way that Lola had translated was the hearer and solitary realizer Arhats, right? Do you know what those mean? Hearers and solitary realizers? You haven't heard that expression before? Of the Hinayana practitioners, there's said to be two varieties, even in the Hinayana teachings, in the Theravada teachings, those that are called Shravakas. Have you heard, maybe you've heard that Sanskrit word, or hearers, or auditors, you could call them. Some people just translate it as disciples, but it's literally the word Shravaka means someone who hears. And then there are some that are called Pratigya Buddhas. They're not Buddhas, fully enlightened, but the etymology is from the word bud, that means awakened. They are, or realizing emptiness. Their realization of ultimate or of reality is one which is achieved by themselves. So they're called solitary or self-realized beings. So that they make special aspirations that in their final, when they achieve nirvana, their arhatship, there won't be a teaching Buddha in the world. They're going to do it by themselves. It's a little bit like those commercials in the 80s or 70s where the mother came in. You remember these? And they said, "Mother, please, I'd rather do it myself." Do you remember this? Maybe some of you. Anyway, just some of you don't remember this. Solitary realizers want to do it by themselves, and they tend to be kind of they're different. Even amongst those, there's different categories. There are some that are called rhinoceros-like, and some that are called congregating solitary realizers. Some will meet with other solitary realizers. Some are even more aloof, like the rhinoceros that supposedly is very solitary. Doesn't some rhinoceri do not go in herds? So maybe you remember from the 12 deeds of Buddha. Some of you who did that course, maybe Thea, do you remember when the Bodhisattva in Tushita Heaven prophesied that he was coming down? Some of the bodhisattvas came down to earth because there were some solitary realizers in India at that time in Deer Park. And they told them, "The Buddha's coming. Split." You know, because they wouldn't want to be there if the Buddha came. That was their, you know, "Oh my gosh, the Buddha's coming." So it said that they rose in the air to the height of what? 8 tala trees or something? I can't remember how high. 12 tala trees. And they what? What did they do?
Tricks to show that there were holy beings there.
I hadn't heard that. What they did was in the Lalita Vistara Sutra, it says that they
concentrated on the fire element and dissolved their aggregates, dissolved in the ashes, and they achieved their nirvana at that point. And the ashes fell down, and that's another name. The name for Deer Park. There's another name. What is it? Something Patana. It's where the ashes of the solitary realizers fell. There's another name for Deer Park, where the Buddha first turned the four wheels. First turned the wheel of Dharma. Okay, it's referring to that. So there are two kinds of Hinayana practitioners: hearers, like Shariputra and Mahamoggallana. Most of the people that we hear of in the sutras are the hearers. We don't hear so much about the solitary realizers. But Rinpoche did say that example of relative Buddha was the hearer and solitary realizer, arhat. And then he said the example of ultimate, as you said, was the what?
Mahayana.
Mahayana arhat. I wanted to ask a question there. What is a Mahayana arhat?
Wouldn't that be? I was wondering the same thing. But I was thinking, isn't that then like at the seventh bhumi when you eliminated all of the afflictive defilements, but you haven't eliminated the obstacles to omniscience? But you, isn't it that at the seventh bhumi you achieve nirvana, like the equivalent of nirvana, because you have no more
after you finish the seventh bhumi? When you achieve the eighth, ninth, and tenth bhumis are called the pure bhumis. Because you've eliminated all of the afflicted obstructions.
So that's
sometimes called Mahayana. Sometimes it's referred to as Mahayana arhat.
But here I think what Rinpoche was referring to is the great arhat, when they referred to Shakyamuni Buddha as the arhat. When you say, tathagata arhate samyak sambuddhaya, when we say these things, the different epithets of the Buddha, he is the arhat. So he's a Mahayana arhat, means a Buddha. So he was referring to relative Buddha jewel was like the Hinayana, Venerable said, Hinayana arhats, hearer, solitary realizer, arhats, and the ultimate would be the Buddha. But this is only rough, as you heard him say later when I ask about the Dharma, because in general, the Hinayana arhat, a hearer, solitary realizer, doesn't have the qualities of actual Buddha gem, Buddha jewel, as the eight qualities will come. So as Rinpoche was saying, this is just kind of something. Sometimes there's something called a common explanation, something that would be kind of you can kind of explain in a congregation of all Buddhists, and they would kind of agree. Sort of like to the common view, the Buddha sat under the Bodhi tree, or the Bodhisattva sat under the Bodhi tree. Was he enlightened according to the common view? No, it's actually exclusive Mahayana view, he was already enlightened. But according to the Theravada, he was on what path, He was actually on the path of preparation. And he went through the path of preparation, finished the path of preparation, path of seeing, path of no more learning on one cushion, and achieved enlightenment. So there are different views about all of these philosophical views about all of these different events. So what Rinpoche was here was giving something that's very, very general and rough. So in general, I don't think you would say the relative Buddha jewel is Hinayana arhat, but this is just a rough description. How about the Dharma jewel or Dharma gem? What do you like better? What sounds better to you? Jewel or gem? Jewel. Anyone like gem better? The three gems? You like the three jewels? Okay. What is the relative Dharma gem?
That's just the printed word.
Printed word? Well, the teachings in general, the printed kind of relative things. And the ultimate was what? Right, Gina?
Truth and cessation?
He said at that point also true paths, true cessation, true paths. What are true cessations and true paths? Where do you find those expressions? Is this some kind of very lofty, high teaching that the Buddha gave after many, many years? It's the Four Noble Truths. Those two are the Four Noble Truths.
No, they're in the Four Noble Truths.
They're in the, which of the Four Noble Truths are they?
The last two.
Third and fourth.
Pardon?
Third and fourth.
Third and fourth, the last two. They're kind of like the solution. The first two are the problem, right? What do they say? If you're not part of the
solution, you're part of the problem? Or vice versa. The first two are what? The truth of the noble truth of suffering, or the Arya truth. Actually, it's Arya truth. When we say noble truths, it's actually a translation. So it's these things are true to Arya beings, those who realize emptiness directly, or let's say who realize the Four Noble Truths directly, realize that these are truths. Otherwise, they're not understood with direct perception as true before that. That's why they're called Arya truths or noble truths. The truth of suffering, all of this, $1 million, beautiful friends, condominium, everything going right, good reputation, all the nature of suffering. All the things that we think of as real happiness, Arya see as the nature of suffering. And the cause of that, the origin of suffering, what is the origin of suffering, Venerable Dina? The second truth.
It's good. That's kind of the root of it. Usually we say karma and klesha. So karma means what? Actions, karma. We know all know the word karma. That's like the immediate cause or origin of suffering. And as you implied by your answer, you said delusion or affliction or klesha. The cause of karma is our ignorance and all of the kleshas that come about because of that.
Then the second two noble truths are the solution, how to get out of that. There is a state of cessation, which is nirvana, peace. That's called the truth of cessation. And the method to actualize that state is the fourth noble truth, the truth of the path. From the Mahayana point of view, it's not so much talking about the Eightfold Noble Path as usually talked about in the Hinayana. Mainly the true path is talking about the actual true path is the meditative absorption on direct realization of emptiness. That's the actual true path. That's what eliminates, that's what causes cessation. Actual direct realization of emptiness, meditative equipoise on emptiness. So, Rinpoche was here saying, my question at the end of the class was with regard to this. So he said, this is just a rough explanation. Maybe in a finer explanation, you'd say the relative dharma is the true path, true paths, and ultimate dharma is true cessation. Maybe there's other meanings. Sometimes these words are translated in different ways. Sometimes in the Lanrim we talk about a representation of Sangha and the actual Sangha. Like, what is the representation of the Sangha? Pardon?
Is it four fully ordained monks?
Four fully ordained monks represent the Sangha. Do you ever see the word relative Sangha? Do you ever use the word relative? Kind of, it's talking about something that represents Sangha now, but ultimately what Sangha actually is what? Arya beings, which means what? Those who can sing very high?
Yeah.
what are Arya beings? Do you know, Judith? Those who've had a direct perception of emptiness.
I wanted you to explain that, the differentiation between an Arya being and an Arhat. I'm getting those two mixed up. And so I wanted to...
I thought you had that straight.
I don't.
Okay.
Sorry.
So, in fact, the translator had misspoke, didn't she? At one point she'd said Sangha were Arhats.
Arya means noble one, and an Arya is a being who has realized, just as Judah said, who has realized emptiness directly. So they have to have achieved what level of the path? What, 10th Bhumi? Path of no more learning. You have to be path of no more learning? Path of seeing.
what Tibetans call Tonglam, the path of seeing, the third path. We talk about five paths. So before this was Abhisamayalamkara. Now I've changed, okay? Is the path of accumulation or collection, where are the being, where, the name of the five paths are the same in the lesser vehicle and the Mahayana. Path of accumulation, path of preparation or joining, path of seeing, path of meditation or familiarization, and the path of no more learning, or you could call it graduation if you want. Path of no more learning is synonymous in the Hinayana path with arhatship. In the Mahayana path, it's synonymous with Buddhahood. So we could say going up to the achievement of enlightenment or arhatship, there are four paths that we have to pass through until we achieve that fifth path, which is the goal. Okay. The first two paths, actually Rinpoche mentioned this a little bit, the defining, sort of like the demarcation between the path of accumulation and path of preparation, is that at that point one has a concentration, a realization of emptiness, but by means of conception, by a mental image, what we call a mental a meaning generality of emptiness. One doesn't have a direct perception of it on the path of preparation. Before that, one may have some understanding of emptiness, even a realization on the path of accumulation, but not a direct realization and not joined with vipassana and shamatha, equipoised on emptiness. When one achieves the path of seeing, the demarcation there is that mental image disappears and one perceives emptiness directly with one's mental consciousness, not with one's senses. One's mental consciousness has a direct perception of emptiness. And at that point, one becomes an Arya being, A-R-Y-A, or Aryan, I guess you could say. An Arya being, or noble being, for the Buddha, is one who's realized ultimate truth like that from this point of view. Because the word Arya was used in India at that time for superiors, the lighter complected people of the original people that came from the Caucasus, I guess, the origin of our Indo-European languages that came down through Iran and Arover, and they came down through India, and of lighter complexion, and the darker complected people, they were forced to refer to them as Aryas, superior beings. So the Buddha, there was a feeling in the time of the Buddha that Arya beings had some kind of implication of your birth or your status or something like that. Buddha said, no, actual Arya beings, actual noble beings, are those who've realized emptiness, who've realized emptiness directly. Arhats are beings who, well, let me put it this way, are arhats necessarily Aryas? What do you think, Venerable? Someone? You sure? Arhats are necessarily Aryas?
They would have to be.
Okay. Mm-hmm. That proves that you know. Okay. I thought she was starting to waver. Are all Aryas necessarily Arhats?
No.
Okay, so that's the thing. An Arya, from the path of seeing, from that moment, one is referred to as an Arya. On the path of meditation, one is an Arya. When one achieves the goal of arhatship or Buddhahood, one is an Arya. So arhats are Aryas who've achieved if we talk about the either Mahayana arhat or Hinayana arhat, have achieved their respective goals. Generally, the word arhat, as the Buddha was giving the etymology, the way that the Tibetans have taken it from some of the shastras, there's an etymology of the word. I believe it comes from Arihan, someone who has defeated the enemy or the foe, or foe destroyer. So that doesn't mean, the outer foes. Obviously, it means the inner foe of the afflictive emotions, as Venerable Sophia was saying before. That's kind of they have eliminated that obstruction from the mind. So they're called foe destroyers. Mahayana foe destroyer, Mahayana arhat, maybe is destroyed not just the klesha, but also the imprints, what are called the jnana, the jnana, how is it, jnana? Jnaya avarana, the obstructions to omniscience, to all knowing. So they've eliminated more, all of the enemies. So you could call them arhats. They are called arhats, but generally we reserve the word arhat to refer to just the Hinayana arhats. Okay, so then we talked about the assembly, and this word is not, the word is not sangha here. It's actually this word, Tibetan word sok, which is, I think, translation of the word gana. Do you know that word, Earl? Gana? Gana. Like when we, you ever do sog puja? You ever do sog puja? You know, the tantric ritual. That's actually in Sanskrit, it's called gana chakra. Or gana. Gana or gana chakra. Sogi korlo. So in some of the, it's a synonym of sangha. Sangha has, also means a particular kind of group. Gana or assembly means the same thing. So what did Rinpoche say here? What is the relative sangha? Venerable Angie, do you know?
You must, yeah, I know you did very well in your exam, so you must have...
Well, that's
what we were just saying now, but that's not what Rinpoche was saying. He was talking about relative and ultimate. I was talking about sometime in the Lan Rim it says someone who is a representation of sangha and the actual sangha. But here the words are relative and ultimate, but not, this is from a common rough point of view, not from the actual meaning of the Uttara Chandra, as we'll see later. What did he say for them?
Yeah,
I just
cheated and looked back at my notes.
Okay, you can check. I'll ask you.
I know.
Oh, you also, but you're okay. Go on.
Well, I had this that arhats and solitary realizers were the relatives. And the arhats.
So hearers and solitary realizers are relative sangha.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's what I wrote down.
Okay, but so there's a word missing. Because hearers and solitary realizers could be on the path of accumulation or the path of preparation. There are hearers, there are people of those lineages. So those are not aryas. You'd have to say hearer or solitary realizer aryas are the relative sangha, as Rinpoche was saying here, right? And just as we said for relative Buddha, Rinpoche had said the hearer and solitary realizer arhats, right?
That's what Rinpoche had said it when he was talking about relative Buddha, remember? Relative Buddha jewel. You don't remember? We just talked about that a minute ago. Sinking in. Do you remember? Okay. Almost still trying to remember this. So here, this is a little bit different. Here, this relative sangha, the way that Rinpoche was giving a rough, common view, Hinayana, Mahayana, not the final view of the Uttara Chandra, the relative sangha was hearer and solitary realizer, aryas. Not necessarily arhats. Vola had originally said arhats, and then she corrected herself the next time, remember? And the ultimate sangha would be what? Mahayana aryas, bodhisattva aryas. Or what? No? Wouldn't have to be Buddha, right? Just have to be aryas, Mahayana aryas. Yeah, as opposed to hearer and solitary realizer aryas. Okay, then potential. Did Rinpoche mention that what a relative, the relative potential was? Do you remember, Bonnie? Did he say?
You're still thinking about the past, present, and future. You're very tenacious. When you get one, you're not gonna. Okay. This young lady, I forgot your name again. No, you?
Yeah.
Sigrid. Do you remember what he said for potential, relative potential, and the ultimate potential?
Yes.
No one knows?
I have changing or developing potential is relative, but essential potential emptiness is ultimate.
Is that what Rishi said at the time?
Yeah.
So when we talk about when we first talked about what this word meant,
here I think Petra had said right at the beginning, there are two kinds of potential that are talked about: developmental potential and the natural abiding or the ultimate potential, the emptiness of our mind. The developmental potential is kind of inferred, like in I won't mention in the Rinpoche has given some explanation of all seven of these points in that verse by Atisha, Sangye Chodong Soke Chognam La, but sort of you can actually see explanations of all seven there. But here, the relative potential would mean that developmental potential, the ability of the mind through accumulating merit to eliminate the stains from the mind. The ultimate potential is talking about the ultimate truth of that mind that still has stains, that's being developed, or not being developed in some cases. Even if the mind's not being developed, it still has a Buddha nature, right? Is your mind being developed? No, I'm just joking. So remember what we said before. There are some reasons we'll see when Rinpoche talks about potential, because a good part of this chapter is talking about potential, to say that the ultimate potential is referring to the emptiness of the defiled mind, the mind that still has obstructions. It's not referring to the emptiness of the Buddha's mind. We can think of it like this, I think. The continuum of our mind goes from beginningless time to, let's say, the present. Here's Bonnie in the present. Okay. Let's not take the present. This is maybe the present's back here with this gold, this little thing his. This is Bonnie's enlightenment. Okay. Her continuum, which is defiled at this point, becomes at a certain point totally free of all obstructions. She becomes enlightened. What is this called over here? What's the continuum? Well, first of all, what's the continuum of her developmental lineage called at that point? The relative mind, what's it called over here when she's Buddha? A little bit mixed up, but there's some, His Holiness and others, when you bring in Tantra and you bring in some other things, usually what we'd say is the nature of our defiled mind now becomes the conventional Buddha omniscient mind, which is called the Jnana Dharmakaya, the wisdom Dharmakaya. There's two kinds of Dharmakaya, right? You know, the Buddha's... When we talk about the Buddha's state, we could divide it into two. The form body, the form manifestation, which is called what? Rupakaya, right? And the Dharmakaya, or the phenomenal, or the Dharma body. Usually, do you know the word Dharmakaya? Kind of, in some literature, people that haven't studied a lot of the, even translators in the past and so forth, they're kind of stymied by that word. It sounds like really, it's so mystical, Dharmakaya, what that means. In many of the Mahayana sutras, though, it's quite laid out, and also in the tantras, Dharmakaya is of two varieties: the relative Dharmakaya, which is like the omniscient mind, which knows the past, present, and future, knows that Bonnie is writing these things down now. And the emptiness, the ultimate nature of that mind, that enlightened mind, what is that called? Rinpoche didn't mention, I don't think. But do you know, any of you know? The ultimate nature of the Buddha's mind? The ultimate nature of our mind with stain is called what? What's the name we've given it to here? Tathagata Garbha, Buddha lineage, potential element. What's the name of the emptiness of the Buddha's mind? Svavavikakaya, right? The nature body. So there's two kinds of Dharmakaya. There's the nature Dharmakaya, which is the emptiness of the Buddha's mind, and the wisdom Dharmakaya,
which is the just the conventional nature of the Buddha's mind. I'm sorry, did I say element? That's the relative conventional nature of the Buddha's mind is called the wisdom dharmakaya. Yeah, there's two bodies, let's say, two kayas, the rupakaya and the dharmakaya. Right? Usually the rupakaya, did Rinpoche mention a little? I don't think he mentioned yet. Rupakaya is divided into, you've heard, nirmanakaya and sambhogakaya. The emanation body, or kaya, and the enjoyment or utilization body. Okay, the Hinayana never talks about a sambhogakaya. It's said to only give Mahayana teachings. It has its own pure land, and lasts until samsara ends. They have many, probably Vasubandhu found many faults with the Mahayana doctrine of sambhogakaya. So on the dharmakaya side, it also has two divisions, but here in terms of relative and ultimate natures. The relative nature of the dharmakaya is called the wisdom dharmakaya, the jnana dharmakaya, and that means the Buddha's omniscient mind, which knows all phenomena, the past, present, and future simultaneously, both truths, ultimate and conventional simultaneously, with direct perception are perceived by the Buddha's mind. The ultimate nature of that mind, because that mind still exists. It doesn't suddenly, you know, once you realize emptiness directly, sort of like some people think the Buddha doesn't exist any longer, it's inexpressible or whatever. From the interpretation of our teachers as they interpret Nagarjuna and Chandrakirti and so forth, we understand that the Buddha's mind does exist. And that's what performs enlightened activity and so forth. Manifests as the Sambhogakaya, Nirmanakaya. That's all from the wisdom Dharmakaya. But what's the ultimate nature of that mind? It's the same emptiness as the emptiness of our mind, but it has a different name because the basis of that emptiness is different. The emptiness of the Buddha's mind is no longer called Buddha potential. It's called Svavavikakaya, or Tibetan saying Ngo Niku, right? The body of entity. The entity, nature body, pardon? Sva, S-V-A, right? Sva, va, V-A. V, V-I. Is that three V's already? Sva, va, V, ka, K-A, kaya. I believe that's the spelling. Is that right, Earl? No, I think there's a V in there. But anyway, we'll check. So, yes.
So the Dharmakaya, I thought you said it was broken down into relative and
ultimate. Right. So the relative Dharmakaya is the wisdom Dharmakaya. The ultimate Dharmakaya is the nature body, the Svavavikakaya. So you see this in the sutras, you see this in the tantras. Sometimes if we talk about two bodies, what are the two bodies? If you see someone saying, the Buddha has two bodies, what are they? Rupakaya and Dharmakaya. If you said he has three bodies, sometimes it says he has three bodies, what are the three bodies? Nirmanakaya, Sambhogakaya, and Dharmakaya. So that's from a Mahayana point of view. Usually we wouldn't find that three bodies talked about in the Hinayana teachings. If you talk about four bodies, you talk about the Nirmanakaya, Sambhogakaya, the wisdom Dharmakaya, and the Svavavikakaya. Okay, both those two are the two parts of the Dharmakaya. One is the relative nature of the Dharmakaya, the omniscient mind, and one of it is its ultimate nature. Okay, so the reason I mention that is that our potential, or let's say Bonnie's potential, when she becomes enlightened, what is now called potential of the defiled mind is called svavavikakaya. Okay? So then when we talked about, Rinpoche mentioned also enlightenment, there was a relative and ultimate enlightenment. Yeah.
I understand the relative or the wisdom, Dharmakaya, but is
his
nature body?
Yeah, so what it means is the emptiness of the Buddha's mind. So you might, it doesn't mean that the Buddha, you know, there's some gaps in the Buddha's mind, there's nothing there, maybe he forgot something, like it's empty, you know. Oh, empty your mind. It's not the meaning of emptiness, right? Emptiness is this concept. One of you asked the question about what the relationship between emptiness and selflessness was. They're actually referring, from highest philosophical point of view, they're referring to the same thing, that phenomena, whether they be persons or other things, say the Buddha's mind, to a certain way of thinking and observing them, they seem to have some kind of findable, real essence that's there. Whereas, when analyzed, they are devoid of that. They are empty of that. The same way that a mirage, when analyzed, is empty of water. Well, what's meant by empty of its own side, you have to investigate what that means. Empty of existing from its own side. We think it almost looks like they're really flowers out here, existing, really findable flowers. Actually, the Buddha perceiving this dependent arising, there's nothing flowerness about this to the Buddha's mind. The Buddha only knows that these are called flowers by depending upon the minds of other sentient beings that still have defilements in their minds, so there's a certain karmic appearance of these as though they were appearing to their own side, from their own side. There's a very complicated subject which is just about to be begun by Rinpoche, the meaning of emptiness. Okay. So when we talked about enlightenment, because we just have a couple more minutes, maybe we'll just finish these and then we can chat after. What was relative and ultimate enlightenment? Did anyone make notes? Frank, you had notes about the other one. Do you have there?
Relative form body is ultimate, would be the Dharma body.
Okay, so the Rupakaya and Dharmakaya, on this rough explanation. Even then, again, if you made it more precise, you'd have to say that of the Dharmakaya, one part of it is relative, isn't it? The wisdom Dharmakaya. So in a fine analysis, maybe you would have to divide it slightly differently. Qualities? Did Rinpoche give relative and ultimate qualities? Okay. So he didn't go into what those 31 were. And then the enlightened activities? Relative enlightened activity? He did say something.
Teaching,
right? So it's said that Lama Tsongkhapa said that of all of the Buddha's enlightened activity, the most supreme was teaching. It is not saying ultimate in the sense, but the most supreme is teaching the Dharma, sort of like the verbal expression, because it's that which leads sentient beings most directly to eliminate their defilements. You know, you can be around a holy being all your life and be inspired by them, but unless you actually have the fortune to hear the teachings that telling you what to do, you can emulate them, and of course, bodily actions can impart a lot of knowledge. But it's said that the Buddha's speech, let's say the Sambhogakaya and so forth, are the ultimate vehicle and the ultimate enlightened activity, the teachings. Even though it might be hurtful sometimes when the guru tells you something that's, you know, they tell you to clean up your act or something like that. But sometimes that's, for beginners, you can't express the teachings directly, can you? You can't, their minds are not strong enough. You can't tell them, give up those things, do this. You know, Tilopa could tell Naropa certain things to do. You know, and you can be led very quickly if you have the fortune to receive the actual teachings of the Buddha in an intimate way. What about the ultimate enlightened activity? Did Rinpoche give a division there? The five types of primordial awareness. So what does that mean? Primordial awareness is what? How else do we translate that? Exalted wisdom. It's the word yeshe in Tibetan, or jnana in Sanskrit. Sometimes people translate it as gnosis. Actually, that Sanskrit word is the basis for our word. Did you know that? Jnana
is the word is the basis for our say Indo-European word gnosis. Gn in Sanskrit is jn with a. They sometimes they put an umlaut on it because it kind of sounds like that jnana. So there are five kinds of, you know, from also from the tantric teachings, five kinds of enlightened of exalted wisdom. So those are the seven vajra points, and those are the main topics that Rinpoche mentioned up till now. He did say the next slide, the entire body of the treatise, I think you mentioned this, in brief, is condensed in these seven vajra categories. And he has not yet gone into the next point. But in a sense, he's finished the whole text. The whole text is comprised in this, right? So don't feel that you've gotten shortchanged. So, just for the sake of being considerate of people that might have other obligations, let's do a short dedication, and then I will remain a little bit longer if anyone wants to ask some more questions, but just so people know that we'll try to be consistent with finishing on time, so that if you won't be put off coming in the future thinking, oh, George, this goes on forever, and I'll never be able to leave. Okay, so let's, first of all, let's try to dedicate in meditation, as we've done in our other classes, rather than using the words of the prayers. The active dedication, as you know, is one in which is likened to prayer, but it's different from prayer in general, in that you're thinking something like this: due to these merits that I've created tonight, that I have created in the past and which have left potentials in my mind that have not yet ripened, due to all of this merit, may it ripen in a particular way. This is the essence of prayer, not of dedication, not merely praying that something happen, but understanding the nature of cause and effect, and that our karmic seeds can be aimed, so to speak, can be dedicated so that they will ripen in certain ways due to our motivation constantly, again and again, motivating, aspiring in that way. So in a minimal way, think, due to these merits I've created tonight and in the past that are still on my mind stream, may they ripen in such a way that they always become the cause for my continued spiritual development in the future, that they not simply be experienced in some pleasure, but may they become the causes of my developing the principles of the path, the pure renunciation, the altruistic mind of enlightenment, bodhicitta, and the right view of emptiness that perceives our Buddha nature. May we perceive our Buddha nature due to these merits. Further, you can dedicate that may they ripen in such a way that they eventually give rise to my own enlightenment so that I can perfectly benefit other sentient beings. So first try to make a relative dedication like that, in whichever way you'd like to dedicate the merits. So thinking, for instance, due to these merits, may I quickly achieve enlightenment for the sake of all living beings, to set them in that same state, then try to seal that relative dedication in what's called the emptiness of the three spheres. The three spheres meaning the merits that we are dedicating, the active dedication, and the goal dedicated to, meditating on each of them as being empty of inherent existence. empty of true existence. The karma that I've created that have left imprints in my mind stream that do have relative potential can't be found anywhere, not just in a sense of they're being immaterial, but in the sense of they don't exist truly the way that our mind conceives of them as findable somewhere or existing from their own side, merely exist as imputations of my consciousness, yet still function. The goal dedicated to my own future enlightenment for the sake of living beings, that goal, although it can be conceptualized and imagined and will eventually take place, doesn't exist the way that our ordinary mind conceives of it. Doesn't exist as how it appears to our mind as somehow a real, findable, truly existent, self-existent event. It's a dependent arising, merely imputed by our mind to certain dependent arising that can occur in the future. Yet it still can arise due to the causes. And the act of dedication that I feel, oh, I've made a very strong, I've been crying, my hair was standing on end, I've made a strong dedication. That dedication can't be found anywhere. It's just a name that we impute to the various instants of mind, thinking of the karma, wishing that it ripen in those ways. So meditate on the emptiness of the three spheres in order to seal this karma in its ultimate sense. You can think there's no ultimate karma, no goal, no dedicator, dedication, all empty.